I want to talk to you today about our scalable server for 3D metaverses. I hope that most of you have read Snow Crash before, but if you're not familiar, a metaverse is a shared 3D space with the unique feature that everything inside of it is editable and scriptable by users. And so what this means is that in a scene like this, with multiple users participating, I can just select an object, say this car, and start changing its appearance, open a scripting window, and edit its behavior. And this all happens real time, live, in the system, and everybody else participating sees the changes as they happen. So you might ask, what's the reason for building one of these systems? It's a really flexible environment, and it leads to a wide variety of interesting applications, from games to augmented reality, historical recreations, collaborative visualization. Those are just a few. But really, the reason we're interested in them is because they open the ability to create these applications to users, which leads to a whole bunch of unexpected and novel applications. They really lower the bar for creating interactive multi-user 3D applications. So even if you're not familiar with graphics and rendering techniques, you can build this type of application. So fiction sort of promises us all of these interesting, expansive, immersive worlds. This is some concept art that an artist made for us, filled with all sorts of novel, user-defined experiences. Unfortunately, what you get today is not quite the same thing. It's very limited. And I'm going to talk particularly about a problem which I'm going to demonstrate right now, which occur in pretty much all of the systems today. So this is actually from Second Life. I just joined a random region and sat there for a minute, let things load in. Everything is loaded dynamically, so it does take a minute. And you might just think, okay, maybe this region is empty, somebody didn't build it up very nicely. But actually, if I take a few steps forward, then suddenly a whole bunch of stuff that I couldn't even see before popped in. And so this is actually really crippling, because this is one of the first things that we want to do when we enter one of these systems. We want to join the world, and I want to be able to look around and find something interesting to go and do. And these systems effectively make it impossible. They won't display things more than a few meters away. And this problem is actually pervasive in the design of these systems and doesn't really have to do with the graphical display. We see it in other aspects of the system. For example, communication is also restricted, such that I frequently can't communicate with objects that are, more than a server or two away, and or the communication is extremely rate limited. And so these really fundamentally are systems problems, not graphics problems. The application is graphical, but the reason that we can't render more objects is because the system isn't telling us about those objects to render. And the reason it's not telling us about them is that we don't really understand right now how to build these systems in a way that both scales and does not sacrifice user experience. And so I'm going to go into detail in this talk about this particular problem, object discovery, and explain why we can't currently see more of these objects in the world. And the reason is that the only way that we currently know how to scale these systems is to do something really simple. So I put a sort of map up here, and the way that today's systems scale is to carve this world up, map each of those blocks into a server. So that's fine, but then in order to not have to maintain replicated state from a lot of servers, we say objects on that central server, clients connected to it, won't be able to see anything beyond that radius. And this obviously scales, because I only need to communicate with a few neighboring servers, so adding more servers is trivial. But this, as I showed before, leads to a pretty uncompelling experience. And we face this challenge more generally throughout the system. And the question that we're trying to answer in this paper is, how do we scale up a world like this without limiting the scope of interaction, meaning both what I can see and what I can actually communicate and interact with? So Suricata is our new platform for seamless, scalable, and federated metaverses. And it tries to address this challenge. I've shown a few screenshots here from applications that were built in Suricata. They were built by undergrads last year, last summer. And the system is still in development. It's by no means complete, but they were able to build these applications pretty quickly. And the ones shown here, none of them are actually possible in other systems today. And so Our solution to this problem is actually based on a really simple insight, which is that we know that the real world scales. And so we're going to apply this principle throughout our design, that whenever we encounter a scalability challenge, what we really need to do is look at how the real world addresses the same problem. And so we want to apply a constraint or exploit some property of objects in the real world such that we'll actually be able to scale the system. And so I'm going to come back to this object discovery problem. So how do we actually remove this restriction that other systems had to place where they're only going to collect state from neighboring servers and then display what appears to be the entire world? Clearly, displaying the entire world itself isn't actually scalable, so we need to limit it somehow. And so Suricata exploits the fact that displays ultimately have a limited resolution. The number of pixels on your screen is limited, so I should only require some fixed amount of data to generate a representation of the scene on screen. So the way we exploit this is through solid angle queries. And solid angle measures essentially exactly what I was just talking about, how large something appears to an observer. So roughly speaking, it is the same thing as the number of pixels an object takes up on screen. And as an example of how this differs from the distance queries, you can think of the sun, which is obviously very important. It's extremely large, but also extremely distant. If you actually represent the sun as an object in one of these systems, other systems will not return it because it's too far away. In our system, because it will always appear large enough to you, it will always be included in the result set. So just to demonstrate the effect that this has, this is actually a sample scene that we constructed, and this is the complete scene. And then if we do what other systems currently do and filter by distance, with about 3,000 objects, this is what you get. And it has this problem that I showed before, that it looks like the world just sort of drops off after a distance. If you do replace this with solid angle queries with the same number of objects, you'll see that the distant mountains pop in, and what we've sacrificed for that is that we drop off a few of the houses that were farther in the distance, and you can barely notice them. So this is a lot better since we now have the mountains, but you'll also notice that there were some things missing in the distance. All of those trees that were covering the mountain are now missing. And so Suricata also does one more thing, which is return aggregates or collections of objects. And we combine them and simplify them so that they're cheaper to display. And when we do this, we actually get a complete view of the scene. All the trees have been filled in, but some of them are at lower quality. And if I just sort of flip between the ideal and the solid angle and aggregates, you can see that it's not quite perfect, but it's far superior to just dropping everything that's in the distance. Okay, so that's the kind of effect we can have, but it turns out that solid angle queries are hard to implement efficiently because they're actually global. So unlike this other type of query, range queries, where we could trivially limit the servers we had to communicate with, the example with the sun demonstrates that anything very far away could be returned in the result set. And so we actually need to communicate possibly with every single server in the system to tell a client what it needs to display. And so our challenge then here is to build an efficient query data structure and a distributed system upon it, which can scale up and filter out all of those objects we actually don't care about. So the core of our solution to this is a novel modification of an existing graphics data structure called the bounding volume hierarchy, or BVH. So what I've shown on the left is an extremely simple scene with just four objects. And the bounding volume hierarchy is called that because we start with a set of objects and just sort of store at each of the leaf nodes the bounds around the objects. I've shown them as circles here, but they're actually 3D spheres. And then we build a hierarchy on top of that. And so each internal node then also maintains a bounding sphere around the objects below it. So I put X surrounding A and B here, Y surrounding C and D. We group things that are close together first. And then finally, we get to some root node Z, which actually encompasses the entire scene. OK, so that's the basic data structure. But now we actually need to add a querier that's asking for any objects that are large enough to appear on screen. So when we run the query, we start at the root node, pointing the pointers at Z. And all we're doing is testing if the bounding sphere is larger than the angle that I have placed on the query here. And this is obviously large enough to hit Z, and so we have to recurse. I'm going to just go down that one branch, and so we hit X. That actually also turns out to be big enough, and so we have to recurse. And so we end up testing all the way down to A and B. And it turns out that neither A or B actually satisfy the query. So we've done a lot of work for no results. But and in fact, in this case, I only showed the one branch, but it turns out you test everything in this tree. So this isn't really doing a great job right now because the data structure is not filtering any of the objects. We actually have to test everything. And the reason this happens is that the bounding spheres are actually really large compared to the objects below them. And while this doesn't matter for range queries, it does in fact matter for solid angle queries, which are heavily influenced by the size of the object. So to make query processing efficient, we augment each node with the largest object in the subtree. So you'll see in the internal nodes of the tree, I've added annotations in parentheses for the largest object. A is the largest object under X. It's also the largest object in the entire tree. And so this is a really simple modification, but what it lets us do is perform a much more efficient test on this data structure. So now, whenever I want to test a node, for instance, I'm going to test Z here, I take the largest object in that subtree, which is A in this case, move it as close as possible to the querier while remaining within the bounding volume Z, and test that smaller object instead. This is essentially the worst case possible object you could have in this subtree, and so it's still a conservative test. It makes sure that we always get correct results, but it's obviously a lot more efficient than testing against the entire bounding volume Z. So the result of this is that we actually cut down the number of nodes tested to 75 to 90% fewer than the corresponding BVH. This is actually this basic modification is what makes it even feasible to perform solid angle queries in the system at all. But it turns out that that alone isn't enough. There are a couple of other problems. The first one is that moving objects will make the LBVH inefficient over time. So as I'll show here, as objects move apart, their parent bounding volume will get stretched farther and farther out. And so the test is going to become less and less efficient over time. We could try to use a complicated approach for updating and reorganizing the tree to keep it efficient. And in fact, we investigated that for a while. It turns out instead we can exploit the natural object movement distributions from the real world. It turns out that they're actually heavily static, and that's also true in a virtual world. What I've shown here is a histogram of object velocities collected from Second Life, and what you notice with the broken bar on the left is that the vast, vast majority of objects are static. So the way we exploit this is actually really simple. We just separate the static objects into their own tree. The static tree stays efficient for much longer periods of time. And then the dynamic tree needs to be updated more aggressively, but it can also become more inefficient because there are far fewer objects in it. And so we just periodically rebuild both of those trees to make sure that they're kept efficient. And the result of this, with just a simple experiment, only 100 seconds long, is that there's a 10 to 15% reduction in the cost of evaluating queries. And that benefit is only going to improve over time because those bounding volumes only get worse over time. So another thing that we exploit is that queries are standing. So what this means is that when we register a query, instead of just getting a set of results back and then having to go ask again periodically for new objects, we continue to receive updates. So if I move closer to an object, maybe it becomes relevant to me, and I just get an addition rather than an entire copy of the results again. So to avoid doing redundant work when updating queries, we maintain a cut through the tree for each query, which indicates where we finished evaluating that query on the last iteration. And then to update the query, we simply walk across this cut and move it up or down the tree. So in this example, I could update this cut by starting at X, and perhaps I moved closer to the bounding volume X, and so now it satisfies the query. And so I refine the cut and now recursively evaluate A and B, and I may end up adding both of them to the results if they satisfy the query. Then we get across over to these other nodes, and let's say that we've actually moved farther away from C and D. Then I step through C, remove it from the result set because it no longer satisfies the query. And then if the same is true for D, then all of the nodes under Y no longer satisfy the query, which means I can actually shift this cut back up. And so the end result of this is that really all we're doing every time we update a query is shifting the cut up and down the tree. For this For just the LBVH, this results in about 20% savings. It doesn't look like much from the previous picture, but it's actually pretty substantial when the tree gets deeper because you avoid all of the internal nodes. Aggregates, which I'm going to explain next, slightly change things, and that actually makes the improvement even better, up to 56%. Okay, and so I explained the motivation for aggregates. We actually want to display objects which individually are not relevant, but collectively are. And so we actually just use the same data structure to generate the aggregates as well. Each leaf node represents an individual object, and so we've got a single mesh at each node. And then we just take internal nodes, collect the meshes below them, combine them, simplify them so that they're cheaper to render. So we have this representation of the two trees combined here. Eventually you get to the root node, which is actually a representation of the entire world, but very simplified. And then the way we actually get these back to the client is that instead of only returning leaf nodes, which represent individual objects, we return all nodes along the cut. And so in this case, we would also return Y containing the two trees. And what's important to note here is that no matter what cut we have, we always have a complete view of the world. So we're guaranteed not to miss out on anything. We just might have some stuff at lower quality. Okay, so that's actually all just a single data structure on a single node. And so we have to move this into a distributed setting as well. This process is actually relatively complicated. I'm going to gloss over it a little bit and just touch on two important high-level points. So the problem here is that eventually, I mentioned queries are global, so eventually every query is going to have to be processed by every server. Which is not going to be scalable. So the first thing we do is recognize that all queries from objects on a single server, because they are all located in the same region, are actually going to have similar results. So what we can do is just aggregate the queries into a single server-wide query, send that across to other servers, get results back, and then filter them further for the individual objects. So this is better. It reduces the amount of inter-server communication, but it turns out you still have to communicate with every other server in order to respond to queries. So if your world is large enough, you're talking about communicating with thousands of other servers constantly. But it turns out that the results you get back will actually end up coming from servers that look sort of like the highlighted ones here, where you mostly have local ones, then maybe you have a couple of objects from more distant servers. So in order to avoid communicating with all of the other servers that are not highlighted, we provide a service that each server communicates with to determine which other servers might be relevant to it. We call this geometric server discovery, and it turns out that this process actually looks a lot like the object querying process. From each server, we want to collect the bounds, the largest object on the server, and then build an LBVH data structure which then can be used to determine which other servers might have objects that are large enough to be returned in a query. This step actually has a similar effect to the LBVH in terms of the reduction in work. We avoid talking to about 90% of the servers in one of the scenarios we show in the paper over a 100-kilometer square region. So once we put this all together, we go from this type of image in current systems to this final display of a large world with many objects. The view is complete, although at lower quality for some regions. And this query actually isn't only used for display either. So we're focusing on display here, but this also bootstraps further communication. So this also means that I can communicate with all of the objects I'm able to see as well. So that's only one of the systems that we had to build to make this world work. We talk about three others in the paper. I'm just going to give you a flavor of each here. The first is a globally consistent distributed data structure, which maps the regions of the world to individual servers. And the challenge here is that each server in the system needs to, at any time, be able to query this shared data structure in order to determine how to direct objects to a server. So if I need to connect at a given location, then I need to know exactly which server to communicate with. In order to scale this, we exploit the fact that at large scales, object distributions move slowly, which allows us to highly replicate certain portions of that data structure. So The other basic service that the system is providing is communication, and that's split into two steps. The first is a routing table, and this routing table needs to be global. We don't want to restrict interaction at all, and so we make sure that all pairs can communicate. This turns out to be not too challenging to scale. We can take advantage of some aggressive caching that exploits natural communication patterns. And then the final step is actually forwarding those messages to the destination objects. We use a forwarder with an intuitive, physically based waiting scheme, which emphasizes local traffic and has some nice guarantees when the system is under load. Okay, so we get to this point and we say, okay, we're able to scale these things a lot better and we haven't limited interaction, but what is this really useful for? So I want to come back to the problem that we talked about at the beginning of the talk. And this application that a student built last summer called WikiWorld tries to partially address that problem. So when I join the world, I want to actually find something interesting to do. And so when the scene actually gets displayed, what WikiWorld does is let you click on an object and pull up information about it based on tags that it gives you. So you message it to get tags, it queries Wikipedia, pulls up a display. So this sounds really simple, and in fact, the student built this really quickly. But this actually isn't possible in systems today, not only because the object wouldn't have been displayed, but because of very stringent constraints on the communication. So I also want to mention that there are a lot of other challenges in the system. We've certainly tried to address some of them here, but we think there's a lot more to do. We're hoping that Sirikata can be the basis for additional research at this intersection of systems, graphics, programming languages, databases, and many other areas. And we think that's actually what makes it a really interesting area to pursue. That combination of requirements makes it a challenging domain. Just to give a taste for some of the other things that we're looking at, we're interested in how you would build audio into the system to get a realistic sound. So you want to be able to support both things like hearing a distant siren as well as supporting or conveying the roar of a crowd, which requires handling thousands of audio streams, mixing them spatially, and doing so under the latency constraints of real-time audio in a large distributed system. Another example is handling property updates efficiently. This is a large fraction of the traffic that you see in the system, just updating properties about any object. You need to distribute these updates to a large number of observers, and they have this interesting property that a lot of these intermediate updates don't actually need to make it through the system as long as we get that final stable state. And current transport algorithms don't really address that well. That's just a couple of examples. So with that, I want to thank you. You can check out the code and download binaries if you want to test out the system. We have a couple sample worlds up. You can find that at sirikata.com, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Yeah, so my question was, you mentioned it, with the first data structure that you put up, you had a 75 to 90% reduction in the amount of traffic that you generated. So the question is, what workload did you use to measure that?
That's a good question. So workloads is one of our big problems. It's hard to collect realistic workloads or even generate realistic workloads. That particular number came from it actually comes from two places. One is just a synthetic workload that's random object sizes placed randomly, uniform distribution. And then there's another workload which is collected actually from Second Life. It uses moving objects and avatars moving around and in theory realistic object size distribution if that's accurate from Second Life. So we tried to do both, make sure it actually applies and works in both situations.
But. Chip Killian from Purdue. So once you've aggregated objects together, how do you then message the individual objects if you want to program one of them?
That's a good question. So right now you can't actually communicate with aggregate objects, and so that is a problem, especially in this example that I gave, right? If I see something that's actually a couple of buildings and I click on it, I won't actually be able to communicate with any of them. This is something we're aware of, and I'm actually trying to address that in sort of the next generation of the system, which gives you a little bit more flexible querying so that you can sort of dig down into those aggregates and find out more about them.
Great.
Thanks, Eli.
Great, thank you.